By a remote, I'm Tommy McNeil. The U.S. State Department has accused Iran of transmitting COVID-19 to multiple countries, saying that in at least five instances, a country's first case of the virus was directly imported from Iran. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told reporters during a visit to Afghanistan that Iran is an accomplice in spreading the virus around the world. Separately, other State Department officials voiced concern that the extent of the damage from the virus in Iran could be far worse than Tehran admits posing a health risk to its neighbors. Tehran, which has been hit harder than any other Middle Eastern country, with more than 23,000 cases, has blamed the United States for its struggles. The Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif Monday decried U.S. sanctions on Tehran as mass punishment, preventing Iran and the world from being able to effectively counter the pandemic. For the first time Monday, the single-day number of deaths from coronavirus in the United States topped 100. COVID-19 has caused deaths in at least 34 states, as well as Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico. More than 41,000 people nationwide have been infected. A fresh week on Wall Street got off to a bad start Monday after the Senate failed again to pass an economic stimulus package to help those hurt by the coronavirus outbreak. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 600 points. It shed 3%. The S&P 500 was also off 3%, while the NASDAQ was down a fraction. All buying and selling was done electronically. The New York Stock Exchange closed its trading floor last week after at least two traders tested positive for the coronavirus. This is VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump has said that Asian Americans should not be blamed for the spread of coronavirus. He made that statement in a news conference and also in a tweet on Monday. The statement was a change of tone for the president, as Mr. Trump has been criticized in recent weeks for referring to COVID-19 as the Chinese virus. The long-awaited trial of a former U.S. Marine facing charges of espionage got underway in Moscow on Monday, with U.S. officials accusing Russia of providing no evidence in a spy case that has proved an added irritant to already troubled relations between the two countries. 50-year-old Paul Whelan was arrested by FSB security agents in late December 2018 after allegedly accepting classified materials on a computer thumb drive in a central Moscow hotel. Whelan has repeatedly denied those charges, insisting he was in Moscow for a friend's wedding and had accepted the drive from a Russian acquaintance without ever knowing or viewing its contents. A member of the International Olympic Committee has told a U.S. newspaper that the 2020 Tokyo Olympics will be postponed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Dick Pound, a Canadian citizen and longtime member of the committee, told USA Today Sports Monday that the games will not move forward as scheduled. He said on the basis of information the IOC has, postponement has been decided. He said details had not been worked out. The games were scheduled to start in Tokyo on July 24th. The U.S. Senate failed for a second time to advance a massive $2 trillion economic aid package to send to most Americans, and many businesses that have been severely impacted by the coronavirus. Democrats say the legislation is weighted too heavily to favor businesses over workers, hospitals, and healthcare professionals. Republicans accuse the Democrats of obstructing the aid at a time Americans need it the most, as the effects of the virus severely impacts their jobs and financial well-being. A team of international researchers has identified 69 drugs and compounds that could be effective in treating coronavirus. A study co-authored by nearly 100 researchers say more than a third of the drugs are already approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and are currently used to treat a range of conditions, including diabetes, cancer, and hypertension. They say studying such known drugs may be a faster method than finding treatment for the coronavirus and try to create a new antiviral drug from scratch. And the USNS Mercy Hospital ship has left its San Diego port for Los Angeles Monday to help support the city's response to an overwhelming number of coronavirus cases. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bundy in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 17th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia's first coronavirus case leads to the suspension of a government official.
When Dr. Blamer arrived at the airport, he evaded the checking procedures that we had, drove away from the airport, and he was in quarantine in keeping with the set protocols that we have at the airport. This led to his suspension for time indefinite by the president.
Eugene Nabu is Liberia's information minister, but the official, Dr. Blamer, says he did nothing wrong. South Africa closes its borders, schools, and public gatherings to slow the spread of the coronavirus. There is concern in Malawi about political leaders trading insults ahead of the May 19th election. And Cameroon separatists said they will sue President Paul Biya in the International Criminal Court. Chris Nano is the spokesperson for the self-proclaimed Amazonian Republic. And we'll tell you about a new report about a 2018 oil pipe leak and toxic waterways in Chad. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia has confirmed its first coronavirus case, and as such, the government of President George Weah has taken a number of actions to minimize the spread of the virus. President Weah has announced the suspension of Dr. Nathaniel Blamer, executive director of the Liberia Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, who tested positive for the virus after returning from a trip in Europe. The government has also closed all schools, including institutions of higher learning, effective Tuesday, March 17. Information Minister Eugene Nabwe says Dr. Blamer evaded check-in procedures set up at the airport and refused to be quarantined.
Today, Liberia was able to confirm the sad news that we had gotten our first positive case of the coronavirus disease. The patient in question is Dr. Nathaniel Blamer, who is the executive director of our Environmental Protection Agency. He had gone to Switzerland. He returned on Friday and was subsequently tested positive by our health authorities. So as a result of that, the president has done a public speech, and he has imposed several new measures aimed at curtailing the disease, including some travel bans to countries that are affected with over 200 cases or so. We've also banned travel of all public officials from Liberia. We've given paid leave to our civil service and other measures. The idea is for us to improve our resilience, strengthen the network that we have so that we can contain this virus successfully.
Minister Nabwe, thank you very much. I saw a press release from the Liberia Environmental Protection Agency explicitly saying that Dr. Blamer voluntarily requested to be rescreened at the Roberts International Airport and that he drove himself to the government quarantine center. But it seems the government is saying he refused to turn himself in. What do you think accounts for what seems to be a discrepancy here?
There's actually no discrepancy between what we are announcing and what actually happened. When Dr. Blamer arrived at the airport, he evaded the quarantine procedures, the check-in procedures that we had, drove away from the airport, and he was in quarantine in keeping with the set protocols that we have at the airport. He drove to his house, and then subsequently, when he was tested positive, there was a medical crew that went to his house with an ambulance. He refused to get on the ambulance. He jumped in his own private car, and you know, a whole plethora of different violations of the protocol. In fact, this led to his suspension for time indefinite by the president. We as a government, we are taking this disease very seriously. And no official is exempt, whether you are a minister, a director, whomever. We all are mandated by the president and by the health protocols that we have set to abide by all of the requirements.
The government has closed schools, Mr. Minister, for 1 week. Is this necessary, or was this necessary?
Yes, at the request of health authorities, we have imposed a 1 week ban on all schools, so schools will be closed for 1 week. The primary reason for that, according to our National Public Health Institute, our Ministry of Health, and our Ministry of Education, is to ensure that the current contact tracing that is ongoing is done without compromising the health and safety of our students. Yes, we know that the expectancy is usually 14 days for quarantine to happen. But this case, the priority now is to effectively carry out contact tracing. And the time required for that, as determined by the experts, is 7 days. So that is the initial closure that period for schools in Liberia, all schools. If there is a determination that we need more time to ensure that the safety of our students, of our children, that measure will be taken additionally. But for now, what we have is a one-week closure of all schools to enable the health authorities to carry out contact tracing and to ensure that the preventive measures are put into place. And we are confident that with the measures that we have taken and the additional measures that will come, we can contain this virus.
Eugene Nambo is Liberia's Information Minister. You're speaking with us from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. The man who was Liberia's first case of the coronavirus says he did nothing wrong. Dr. Nathaniel Blamer, Executive Director of Liberia's Environmental Protection Agency, says airport authorities misinformed President George Weah about what actually transpired at the Robert International Airport upon his arrival from Europe. President Weah suspended Dr. Blamer because he said Blamer breached the protocol set up at the airport to screen for the coronavirus. But Dr. Blamer says he followed official procedures. In fact, he said he even requested for additional testing after going through screening at the airport.
Look, I want to just urge you guys to be calm. I'm not doing anything out of protocol. I talked to the doctor, and the doctor advises I'm okay to not create panic. I should drive myself to the hospital, and the ambulance will be going to drive behind me. And we just that. Why are you guys panicking? Talk to Dr. Keto. Talk to Dr. Fala. That's what we agreed. Okay? And when they brought the ambulance in the community, the community members got concerned and were running behind it. After even the health worker escorted me and I got in. And now you guys, you have done enough damage by misinforming the public, you know, that I refuse quarantine. That's not true and that's not fair.
That was Dr. Nathaniel Blamer, the man said to be the first case of the coronavirus in Liberia. South Africa has announced strong measures to slow the spread of the coronavirus just a week after the nation saw its first case, and then tens more in the space of a week. On Sunday, President Cyril Ramaphosa effectively shut down all borders, schools, and large gatherings across the country. In Johannesburg, the nation's economic and transport hub, residents reacted to the news. Here's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The rise of coronavirus cases in South Africa has prompted President Cyril Ramaphosa to announce tough measures to try to slow the virus from spreading. Ramaphosa on Sunday banned travel from high-risk countries, public gatherings of more than 100 people, and closed all schools from Wednesday.
We have decided to take urgent and drastic measures to manage the disease, protect the people of our country, and to reduce the impact of the virus on our society and on our economy. We have now declared a national state of disaster in terms of the Disaster Management Act. This will enable us to have an integrated and coordinated disaster management mechanism that will focus on preventing and reducing the outbreak of this virus.
The travel ban includes anyone arriving from Britain, China, Germany, Iran, Italy, South Korea, Spain, and the United States. South Africa's government this past weekend repatriated 114 of its citizens from Wuhan, the Chinese city where the outbreak started. They will be kept in quarantine for 3 weeks, though none have tested positive for the virus. In South Africa's economic and transportation hub, Johannesburg, the city's minibus taxi ranks are usually a hive of activity. But on Monday morning, the streets were quiet, as people appeared to be taking the president's warnings seriously. 74-year-old lawyer Philip Vallette says he is worried about the toll on his business.
My worry is how long is it going to take? Because from our business point of view, and if we have to shut down parts of our business or drastically interfere with our business's run, I'm just worried about how long we can stand it. And I'm worried about our staff. I'm worried about the taxis. If there are no taxis and there are no buses, we might not have a business.
Project manager Pili Chikale says she may have to cancel as many as 18 upcoming plans, but she agrees with the president's strict measures.
I think it was just the right time because of all this time we've been taking this disease lightly. It's only now that the president has made us aware of the seriousness and how much it's going to affect us that we're also aware that, oh no, this is really a big deal. and we should now start taking care of us all.
But not all South Africans are concerned about coronavirus. Some say they'll continue as usual, like sales consultant Mandla Tmube.
I'm not worried, not a bit. I mean, at work, I'm already, you know, exposed. I said my guys are well-traveled, so I'm exposed. So I'm already exposed, so I can't lose at work. And
but Ramaphosa is urging the Rainbow Nation, already struggling with high unemployment and power cuts, to rise to the challenge posed by coronavirus. The respiratory illness has infected a confirmed 170,000 people worldwide since December. But health officials fear the number of unconfirmed cases could be much higher. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 17th. The Malawi Law Society and religious groups have expressed concern about political leaders trading insults ahead of the much-anticipated court order May 19 presidential election rerun. Local media report incidents of insults at the campaigns of both the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP, and the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, the NCP. Nicholas Dawusi, spokesperson for the DPP, says it is regrettable that the opposition labels leaders of the group as witches, but some NCP supporters say they are simply repeating a claim by the General Secretary of the DPP, who described herself as a powerful witch. Charles Kajo Loweka is Executive Director for Youth and Society, a human rights and governance watchdog in Malawi.
But Charles, I heard former Home Affairs Minister Nicholas Dawusi, who is also the spokesperson for the ruling DPP, saying that they take strong exception to the fact that the opposition is calling them witches within the party. What do you make of this?
I think the issue of calling each other witches was started by the ruling party itself last week in Blanta, when they held a political rally there. And one of the leaders of the Democratic Progressive Party, particularly their general secretary, is the one who had boasted that they would deal with human rights defenders, and that she, as a woman, was the toughest witch, that nobody would survive, you know, her magic or, you know, her black power. And the, what she meant was to send a strong message to the human rights activists that they were prepared to deal with the human rights defenders mercilessly. So the mentioning of being a witch was in the context of really emphasizing how determined they are to deal with the human rights defenders in Malawi.
So how are civil society groups and other stakeholders, including the church mother bodies, reacting to this incident of politics of insult ahead of the presidential election rerun?
Quite a number of stakeholders have condemned the hate speeches coming from the political podiums, particularly by the ruling Democratic Progressive Party and its entire leadership led by President Mutharika. We have seen the Public Affairs Committee, which is a quasi-religious body that played a very key role in the transition from one-party state to multi-party democracy, and that is one reputable religious body in the country that has condemned these hate speeches coming from the ruling party. We have also seen the Malawi Law Society joining the cause for sanity in terms of public speeches made by politicians, and not to incite violence, and also the attacks against human rights defenders that we have witnessed for the last 2 weeks.
How about the issue of the preparation of the Malawi Electoral Commission ahead of the much anticipated May 19th presidential election rerun, since it appears that they got delayed with preparation for the election? What is the major concern here, if I may ask you?
It is fundamentally important to note that the current Electoral Commission and its leadership cannot be trusted by many stakeholders. For 9 months, Malawians, led by civil society and various stakeholders, joined in protesting against the outcome of 2019 elections. It was strongly believed that the elections were fraudulent and therefore could not really be declared credible. And indeed, after the Constitutional Court judgment, it was very clear in the finding of the court that the 2019 elections were fraudulent and indeed not credible. Therefore, it also found, in fact, that the commission was incompetent in the management of the elections. It further ordered Parliament to further assess the capacity and competence of the commission. And again, in the finding of the National Assembly, that's Parliament, it also confirmed that this commission did not have capacity. It was incompetent. So that was the last nail on the coffin of this commission.
Charles Kajo-Loweka is Executive Director for Youth and Society in Malawi. You're speaking with VOA's Peter Korte from the capital, Lilongwe. Cameroon separatists say they plan to sue President Paul Biya and what they call his collaborators sometime this month in the International Criminal Court for perpetrating genocide in the country's English-speaking regions. Human rights groups have accused both the Cameroon government and the separatists of human rights violations and crimes against humanity. Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed interim government of Ambazonia. He says the separatists hope President Paul Biya and his territorial administration minister and others will end up at The Hague behind bars like former Chadian President Issen Habre and Charles Taylor of Liberia. Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed interim government of Ambazonia. He was speaking with us from the U.S. city of Houston, Texas.
We are formally initiating a lawsuit at the International Criminal Court against Paul Biya, the president of French Cameroon, and his close collaborators who have perpetuated the genocide and the razing downs of towns and villages in the southern Cameroons. We had a press conference with our lawyers, the Washington D.C. law firm that will handle the case. We had a press conference last weekend, and we are going forward with it, and we are hoping that Paul Biya and his territorial administration minister and the rest will end up at The Hague behind bars, like Issen Habre of Chad, Charles Taylor of Liberia, and we can name the rest.
But are you not also concerned that perhaps the government or some Cameroonians might want to also take you to the International Criminal Court because they might accuse you of the same thing?
No, they cannot accuse us of the same thing, James. We are defending ourselves. We did not declare war. He declared war on November 30, 2017. We did not declare war. When this struggle began, there were no arms in Ambazonia. We took up arms for self-defense purposes. And you will realize that throughout the prosecution of the war, we have not crossed the Mongol. We have not crossed our territory to attack French Cameroon. We have remained within our territorial boundaries to defend our people and defend our territory, and we will continue to do that. This is war. People will die on both sides. We will kill some of them. They will kill some of our soldiers. And so the problem with them is they are killing innocent civilians. That is a problem. Raising down towns and villages. They are all documented. The data is there. So when you say they are going to sue us, I don't see what they are suing us for.
The coronavirus, how has it impacted your struggle?
We hope that it impacts French Cameroon soldiers and their administrators. We are safe in the southern Cameroons. No coronavirus in the southern Cameroon. We hope that it takes French Cameroon as a plague.
Chris, thank you very much again. So nice to talk with you.
My pleasure, too. Thank you.
An oil pipe leak and toxic water spill in Chad in 2018 injured dozens of residents, and the oil field operator ignored reports of serious health repercussions, according to a new report out by the corporate watchdog RAID. The group's executive director, Annika Van Woudenberg, spoke to Ricky Strike about how one of the largest natural resource companies in the world, Glencore, has refuted the claims and continues to ignore the negative effects on the lives of the residents.
We went to find out what was happening as a result of the wastewater spill, because local residents were raising significant concerns. And what we found in our research were that at least 50 local residents, many of whom were children, said that following the wastewater spill and the oil pipe leak, they suffered skin burns, skin lesions, pustules. Others had blurred vision, stomach aches, and were vomiting. And they were all extremely clear that this was as a result of some type of toxic substance in the water, and they very clearly link it to the wastewater spill coming from Glencore's Badila oil field operations.
And Glencore has refuted these claims, is that correct?
Well, Glencore admits that there was indeed a wastewater spill. And in fact, the way in which this was handled also raises some serious questions, because the wastewater basin, which contains something called produced water, which is a byproduct of oil drilling. And this basin was built in a rather hasty fashion and begun to leak very quickly after its construction. And when the local people raised concerns about the leaks, Glencore did very little to try to repair the basin. They did some very basic pumping, but then said to the local communities, we're going to have to do a controlled spill. And when they didn't provide information to local chiefs as to whether the water was safe, local chiefs said absolutely not. But sure enough, shortly thereafter, the basin ruptured. And Glencore does not dispute that that occurred.
And how does this highlight what a raid, or maybe you see as a lack of oversight, a lack of responsibility in the way Glencore and I'm sure other companies, to be honest, operate in these rural areas where there's perhaps little oversight and where perhaps the populations are more vulnerable because they don't have access to power or economic means?
Look, I think for me, that's what's so clear in this case, is Glencore turned a blind eye to the dozens of injuries and reports that they received of livestock deaths following the wastewater spill and the oil pipe leak. And rather than investigating and really looking thoroughly at what was happening, they just brushed them aside as if these reports were of no consequence. So we are today nearly 18 months after the wastewater basin had ruptured and flooded into the local river, a river that local people use for bathing, for washing, for watering their livestock. They still haven't conducted a thorough or independent investigation. And what Glencore has done is they hide behind water analysis they did the day before the spill.
That was Annika van Woudenbroek, the executive director of RAID, a corporate watchdog. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. That's it for this Tuesday, March 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm Jen Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.